Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Folks, welcome to this incredible throwback episode with the amazing Jeanette Nyden and the incredible Lawrence Kane, where we talk all about developing a contract playbook. You see, there's a lot of people retiring in the procurement and the sales world, and there are playbooks that are inside their heads that we need to get out. And these folks have done that. They talk all about how to do that and how teams can implement the development of a contract playbook. Really, really, really important stuff, especially if you're in the procurement game, to have this at your fingertips. Enjoy this great episode with Jeanette Nyden and Lawrence Kane. Jeanette and Lawrence, we made it. Thank you so much for being on. It is incredible to finally have you guys on the show. You know, when we ran into each other, I think it was at ProcureCon West, we were talking about your new book and how excited you guys were about that contract professionals playbook. And I am so excited to talk to you both about it today. So thank you so much to both of you for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely.
Well, we're going to have a lot of fun today, guys. I think, you know, one of the things that we often talk about in procurement is that, hey, we've got to have a playbook. Let's develop a playbook. Let's figure out what we're going to put in our playbook. And no one ever actually gets to developing that playbook, which is, I assume, where the idea for the book came from. But maybe, Jeanette, you can tell me, like, why develop this contract professionals playbook?
That's a fabulous question, because it actually came from an idea that I got from a sales trainer and consultant friend of mine. Several years back when I was writing Getting to We with Kate Vitasic and David Fringlinger, I was speaking at a conference, and it was a sales-oriented conference. And I ran into the woman at the restaurant at the hotel for the conference, and she was working on this quote-unquote playbook. And I said, what do you mean? What is this playbook? And she said, oh, it's a playbook for sales and et cetera, et cetera. And she talked to me a little bit about it high level. And we had our breakfast at the hotel and went off to the conference. And I spoke at the conference. And flash forward about 2 years, the state of Washington asked me to develop a comprehensive online training for their procurement enterprise-wide level department for contract management. So the training was from the enterprise-wide level department within the state of Washington, but it went to all agencies. And my assistant and I were talking about the project, doing our lessons learned. And she said, you know, I bet you could make this into a playbook for both sales and procurement, because there's a lot missing, because this was just for the state of Washington and just for procurement. I met Lawrence about maybe 6 months after that, and this whole idea of developing this playbook for contract professionals, irrespective of whether they're procurement or sales, blossomed, took shape, and Lawrence added so much value to what the project looks like today. And you're right, procurement doesn't necessarily invest in playbooks, but I have seen sales organizations that do. So I think that that's a fascinating difference between sales and procurement.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think one of the key things that's missing is sort of like that step-by-step playbook guide. And I'm so glad that you guys have come up with it. Lawrence, when you guys were writing this book, there must have been some changes that you were seeing in the contract and procurement world. And there must be something that you had to do to figure out how are we going to impact the knowledge and the changes that are happening. So when you were going through that process, what changes were you seeing?
Well, there's quite a few, actually. So first one is we're moving up the value chain as a profession. Think about, you know, people have been buying stuff for thousands of years. Our industry used to be called purchasing, right? And then eventually it became procurement. Now you see strategic sourcing, you see business optimization, other titles like that. So what we're trying to do is not just buy stuff, but actually build relationships with suppliers that move the enterprise. Combine that with, you rarely get that out of college. Most of the people who are good at that are, you know, old people like me who are close to or at retirement age. I don't plan to retire anytime soon, but I could if I wanted to. And the folks who are needing to get the skills that folks like Jeanette and I have don't really have a good mechanism to do it. So when we started talking about this concept, we were thinking, you know, folks might have a supply chain degree or they might have some kind of philosophical high-level information, but they really don't have the step-by-step how to go and do this stuff in a way that's going to be guaranteed outcome and really be able to create that enterprise-enabling value that we need to do. So we really built this as a hands-on way for folks who know how to buy stuff to move up that value chain and to take the knowledge that the folks who've been doing it for a while don't have time to hand out and give to their rest of their staff or the new people in their organization and really build that talent pipeline and make it easy for them. So it's not just a book. There's actually some other corresponding courses that we've done. There's video, there's online learning, there's all kinds of stuff that we've added to it to try to accommodate various learning styles and make it as easy as possible to transfer that knowledge so that ultimately we can take the state of our profession and kind of raise the bar and have better outcomes and really have that seat at the table with the business, like, you know, the folks that are actually selling stuff, as an example.
I love that. And you know, one of the big issues that I've seen, not only in procurement, but all disciplines, is because the workforce is going to be basically retiring fairly soon, right? There's all this knowledge, at least the experienced workforce is going to be retiring. There's all this knowledge that needs to get transferred, but no time to transfer it. And even when they decide to leave, no one's really doing that mid-level succession planning to help those younger people to fill those roles. And because they're coming out of university with great theoretical knowledge, but not necessarily great practical knowledge, now they're stuck, right? They're stuck in a position of like, holy shit, I have no idea what the hell I'm doing. And all of the people that could teach me have left. So what do I do? And so that's amazing that you guys have come up with basically a tool to be able to help them with that. You know, when we're talking about the book itself, though, what's included in the book? Because when we think about risk and contracts and all of that kind of stuff, we could really go for forever. So when we think about the playbook, step by step, walk me through, what does it take us through?
So, Mark, that's a great question, because our view has always been, well, we've got to help our profession. But what you understand is when you move up the value chain, as Lawrence just described, we are also interfacing with people in the line of business who equally don't know what the contracting process is either. And yet those individuals in the line of business may be partially or fully responsible for developing the specification. And then on the procurement side, they're fully responsible for the P&L value gain or loss. So the book looks holistically at the profession, and it really starts at the very, very beginning, which is, what do we mean by value? What are the four types of value that I talk about in getting to we? It moves through, how do you work with your internal stakeholders in an effective and robust way, because you're leading them to develop a robust statement of work or a robust review of a proposal. And then we start moving into the various elements of the actual work of the three phases of the contract lifecycle. So you know, how do you develop a statement of work or how do you revise a statement of work? How do you then look at pricing models? How do you look at pricing value? You know, what is a cost plus incentive? What are the pros and cons? Would that work in your situation? All the way through how to redline a contract during the award phase, some negotiation tips and tricks along the way with the award phase, and then we move into the contract management post-execution phase. How do you now manage this contract that's been written? And if you're the one that wrote it, you've got to manage it, then that's a little bit easier. But what happens in organizations where the people who write and negotiate the contract then turn that document over to a project lead, as they do in the state of Washington, and likely the person who wrote the contract is not the person who's managing it. So now how do we develop contract summaries? How do we develop governance within the organization? How do we learn how to have conversations to kick a project off or terminate early if that's what needs to happen in the relationship? So it's a full cycle, but at every step of the way, Lawrence and I were very clear to say, you're negotiating externally with your counterpart and you're negotiating internally with your stakeholders and your leadership.
Speaking of negotiation, Lawrence, maybe you can speak to this. I want to understand, you know, we've got a bunch of different ways that we could, or at least philosophies when it comes to negotiation, that zero-sum game of, you know, winner takes all, I get everything, you get nothing. And then that's one extreme. And then on the other extreme is that, you know, win-win, super collaborative, kumbaya, everyone wins kind of idea. Where do you guys sit when it comes to that?
So our focus has really been on performance and outcome-based contracting, which drives a little bit more of that, you know, vested or collaborative style of negotiation. That doesn't mean it's always appropriate, but it's appropriate for the hard stuff. So, you know, if I'm going to buy a widget and I could do a reverse auction or something, great. But if I'm going to buy innovation, well, that's not so easy, right? That really relies on having a supplier who's operating a lot like a partner. And if you think about like, I'm a big football fan. My son played football in college. And you think about like the NFL, right? If somebody is negotiating a contract, you get an agent for the player and you get the general manager for the team. The coach and the player, who are the ones who work together every day, aren't part of that negotiation, so that you don't have that ill will, right? Because they have to get along really well in order to be able to go win games and bring back championships. So, you know, you can set up things systemically where you have, you know, procurement's the bad guy to be, you know, the hard level negotiation, but the people who manage the contract are more in get along mode. But frankly, it doesn't always work that way. And there's still ill will if you do the, you know, sort of the old chessboard style, use your power kind of negotiation for something where the relationship matters. And so all negotiations aren't the same, but certainly when you're trying to have something that's going to really be business enabling, more often than not, you're going to be along the line of what Jeanette talks about in Getting to We, or Kay talks about Invested, where you're going to be having more emphasis on the relationship and how you work together and how you're going to do insight instead of oversight and things like that, which means you need to set all that up from the day one on the strategy, and it carries through the negotiation and into governance.
I'm glad that you said that, because I think that one thing that people get wrong about negotiation is they think it has to be one or the other. They think that the two are mutually exclusive. And what I think that you've defined really well is it really depends on what the strategy is, right? I mean, very typically, if you look at it from a procurement lens and you're looking at how to define your category strategy through the Kralik matrix, if you're in the bottom left-hand corner and it's super tactical, let's just say MRO, for example, right, then you know that it's super tactical, there's lots that can be provided, you know, that zero-sum negotiation is probably something that you're going to lean more towards on the spectrum, whereas if it's super strategic, top right-hand corner, you know, high risk, high spend, then you're going to be definitely something that's more collaborative. And so many people go into negotiation thinking, you know, I have to be one or the other, but I can't necessarily be both. But the key is to understand, okay, what's the strategy first? And now, how do we adjust our negotiation style to fit that strategy?
Mark, I've got a great point on that. And the idea is, and Lawrence and I talk about this in one of our chat sessions, is, you know, what really warrants you being tough? And when do you need to step away for the sake of the relationship? So I was co-negotiating a deal, probably about $100 million when it was all said and done. It's approximately $7 million a year maintenance and operation. And then there were some investments, capital investments that needed to be made. And this is a very large global company that we were negotiating with. I was on the procurement side. And we were negotiating the termination fees for cancellation for business reasons. So if we canceled it for business, how would we calculate what we still owed to recoup for the investment that they were making for capital improvements, et cetera, right? And they had a formula that made zero sense. It was not an accounting methodology that I recognized. It was just a stair-step percentage, year one, year two, year three, et cetera, right? And I'm like, no, I'm sorry. This is not working for me. And I started getting more agitated because I knew what I was asking for. And the salesperson, the sales negotiator, actually had the audacity to say to me, and Lawrence laughs when he hears this, you don't know what you're asking for. And at which point my co-negotiator, Brian, shakes his head and says, I don't think you should have said that. But the point is I wanted to get really tough, and I really wanted to put my thumb down and say, you're going to give me an amortization schedule that makes sense, because I don't think I should be paying this much starting year 5, 6, or 7. But I think if we cancel in year 2, I should owe you way more money than what you've got calculated here in this table. And I went to the sourcing gods that are, they all agreed with me. Our boss then went into the line of business and said, we'd like permission to really push back on this, and this is why. And the line of business looked at the table, they shrugged their shoulders, and they said, we cannot cancel for convenience. We will do anything, but there is no other option than to figure out how to work with them for the duration of the contract. So I don't care, and I'm not going to give you guys permission to push if it means that there could be a delay in getting it launched, or even a possibility that the supplier could take a step back. And as a result, my marching orders were to make the relationship work. And fortunately, you know, my counterpart and I are sophisticated enough, we didn't poison the well, right? I mean, when Brian said, you shouldn't have said that, you know, I wasn't frustrated or upset in a way that would damage the relationship, but I was very clear, I knew what I was asking for. And I didn't get it. And our business didn't get it. And we're, you know, 4 years into this agreement now, and there's no end in sight that this vendor is in any way, shape, or form at risk. So the point is our jobs are so much more complicated now that we have to be very careful about what tough means and when to be tough. And we have to be willing to take our marching orders from other people who might shrug their shoulders and just say, eh, not worth it.
Ninjas, do you want to supercharge your negotiations? Join me in San Francisco, February 24th through 25th, for a live negotiation workshop. Here's the deal. I have 20 free tickets. So I need you to go to spark.scoutrfp.com and use my exclusive code NINJA2020. That's NINJA2020. These tickets are going to go fast, so you got to grab them right now. Go to spark.scoutrfp.com and use the code NINJA2020 for your free ticket. Spark is a unique conference experience hosted by Scout RFP, the easy-to-use sourcing and supplier engagement platform that's trusted by over 220 global brands. Now, I was in Spark in 2019, speaking with some of these customers like Adobe and Salesforce, LendingTree, and many more, and it was so inspiring. I cannot wait to see you in San Francisco at Spark in 2020. Don't forget, the tickets are free for a limited time at spark.scoutrfp.com with the code NINJA2020. Go and grab them right now.
And so maybe you can help me to understand during that period where you basically got the marching orders from the business to go a certain direction. And let me be clear for all of those who are listening to this. Hey, we're a service-based organization. Ultimately, our job is to help the business. And if they decide that they want to go a certain direction, at some point in time, we're going to have to either convince them that that's not the right choice, or if they're super firm on it, we're just going to have to do it. And when that happens, how do you manage your level of frustration around that? Maybe, Lars, I'll give this one to you. How do you, when you get into that kind of a situation and you know that this is the wrong direction, but you've already received these are the orders, obviously the situation is going to be tense. How do you manage your level of frustration when that happens?
Sure. That's a great question, Mark. And, you know, you've interviewed like hostage negotiators in the past, and you've talked to people who do things around the violence continuum. And I have a very unusual position of having worked security for 26 years and having done martial arts for over 40. And so, you know, when you've been shot at and stabbed, words don't matter, but that doesn't work for everybody. And so the way I look at it, it's all about what's the outcome, right? If my ego is in the process, it's not going to work and I'm going to get real upset and frustrated and it's going to be bad. If my ego is in what's best for my organization, it's a lot easier. And that's really what I teach the folks that I mentor. It's about what is the right thing for the company. So it might be the business partner knows something we don't and something we're really concerned about. And you find that a lot with terms and conditions, right? Limitation of liability, insurance indemnification, all these things that you spend all kinds of time arguing about, where sometimes it's really, really critical. And sometimes it's a matter of, if I understood the business better, I'd realize like my business partner, this just doesn't matter, right? But what I need to do is make sure that the team I'm working with fully understands what the situation is and what the ramifications might be. And then they make an informed choice, right? The P&L leaders are P&L leaders for a reason. You know, they're not dumb. They might not be experts in contracting and experts in procurement, but they are experts in the business. And so there's really, you know, if your headset is in, I want the right outcome, then it's actually kind of hard to take it personally, because it's really about doing what's right for the business. And if somebody knows something I don't, it's like, oh, gee, well, I didn't know that. Okay, let's pivot. On the other hand, if it's all about I have to win, then I'm going to have trouble. And so I do a lot of things to help folks who, you know, where if you think about from a violence dynamics perspective, if the worst thing that's ever happened to you is someone said a few bad words, that's really meaningful, right? And it can get you really riled up. And so I teach folks things like various types of meditation. I talk about strategic breaks in you know, conversations. I talk about a lot of body mechanics, you know, breathing and other things that help people to not get all riled up from words, where, you know, most of the folks that I hang out with outside of work, that's not an issue. But the people that I hang out with inside of work, you know, their worst day was somebody cut them off in traffic or said a few bad words. That's a lot different, right? And so it becomes much more meaningful, because that's the scariest thing you've been involved in. And that is something where you can take the same kind of tactics and tricks you use for people who've been in combat and actually apply them in a somewhat subtler way, for lack of a better term, to folks who are involved in high-risk negotiations or high-dollar negotiations, and make it much less stressful.
Very, very cool.
Mark, if I can, Mark, if I can jump on, you know, yeah. I personally have been coached by Lawrence about breathing. And so, you know, we are in stressful situations, sometimes in our personal lives, that can then influence how we show up at the bargaining table. You know, we can all have parents who are dying, children who are sick, we can be going through divorce or something really catastrophic, and bring that into the negotiation, which then also impacts our ability to control ourselves. So we don't even have to be in a situation where we're being physically attacked, although I thoroughly understand where Lawrence is coming from, but we can feel that attack on an emotional level, and it can still negatively influence us as negotiators. And that's where Lawrence is saying, you know, the more that we can be emotionally in control, the better that we're able to represent our organization in these really complex ways. And I just wanted to give a shout out because Lawrence was really there for me at a time in my life when he's like, all right, I'm going to tell you what you need to do. You need to meditate and you need to breathe in this way. And it was so helpful. So appreciate that.
Fantastic. You know, one thing that I think can help limit the frustration, especially once the contract is done and performance has begun, is having really good performance-based and outcome-based KPIs and SLAs and all that kind of stuff in the agreement, because it limits the BS, really, let's be honest, right? It limits the nonsense that can occur of like, did you do it? Did you not do it? Whose fault was it? All that kind of stuff. When you're going through this, developing this playbook, and you're talking about putting those things in there, what is it that the one piece of advice that you would want to give to like a developing professional, you know, that's reading through this? Why is it that we need to have those important metrics in place in our agreements?
I'll start. I'm working on this right now with a more junior, less experienced contract negotiator. Is that not ever having had to manage a complex agreement, there's a lack of clarity about what the contract management role is and how the contract itself is in fact a tool. And I'm not comfortable when people tell me, oh, a contract is something that goes into a drawer. A contract in the world that Lawrence and I work in is a very dynamic world with change orders and modification and scope changes. And so as a living, breathing document, this document, the KPIs, the reports, how often we meet, who is present at QBRs and annual meetings, what we expect from those folks when they are there present for these meetings, is part of that living, robust relationship. And what the document does is then provide the guidelines for people who are new to the relationship a year, 3 or even 5 years after the agreement's been executed.
Love that.
And hey, Mark, let me add to that real quick, if I could. One of the things so my organization just got an award around governance and compliance for a 30-year software deal that we did. I actually said that right, 3-0, right? How often do you sign a 30-year deal for anything, let alone software? We had to create a governance process that would outlive all the people that negotiated the deal. And we knew that knowing what gets measured gets done. So we actually spent more time thinking about how do we know if this is successful and what are we actually trying to do over time than we did the specific details around the rest of the statement of work. In other words, the SLAs and other measures were some of the most important things that we put in there beyond the governance process to make sure that it was sustaining. And my reason for bringing that up is that the ability to really manage, like Jeanette was saying, is that contractual framework. If it sets you up for success by measuring the right things, a lot of the problems that could turn into lawyers at 20 paces or whatever is going to be one of those things that you actually can work out through relationships and conversations, as opposed to having to do anything extreme and or end up in court. If you haven't set it up for that, it doesn't work so well. And so one of the things that we always do when we are creating contracts is we have folks who are experienced vendor managers that we pull in to say, what's the challenges that we could expect from this based upon what the business requirements are, and how would we measure whether or not we're moving in the right direction?
Like doing a really good pre-mortem, essentially.
Exactly, right.
Yeah, brilliant. I think not enough can be said about having really robust dispute resolution clauses in agreements, because sometimes, like you mentioned, Lawrence, we let our egos get the best of us whenever it comes to maybe a dispute that comes up mid-agreement or some way through the agreement. And, you know, we get into the blame game. And not having that process in place really puts us into a position of having to figure it out on the fly. And so that dispute resolution process in the agreement is so, so important. And yet I find it's so overlooked in agreements where it's just, you know, standard templated copy that's in the agreement that no one ever looks at. But if you've been in that kind of a situation before, you very quickly realize why that's there. And I think a lot of people that are coming up now that they need to pay attention to is, number one, where are your outs, right? Where can you terminate for convenience and all of that kind of stuff for cause? But before you even get to that point, how are you going to manage that dispute process? Because you don't know if you're so deep in the weeds, you don't know if your ego is getting the best of you. And sometimes you need that process to really manage your own emotions so that you can go through it. What do you think about that, Jeanette?
Yes. So as a lawyer, right, I've got two different thoughts. As a lawyer, the dispute resolution clause looks like this. First, we're going to negotiate in good faith. And then if that doesn't work, we have every right to sue the pants off of you and to pursue every legal option, you know, known to mankind, unless it's a consumer agreement. And then we're going to go to arbitration and the big company will choose the arbitrator. And so it really is a block paragraph that's about, you know, 40 words. 100 words long. And that's what we consider dispute resolution. But in the world that Lawrence and I live in, dispute resolution could be everything from interpreting a change order to interpreting a work authorization to changing a key personnel out. You know, the supplier is just not got the right team member for that particular position, the culture fit is not there. And when you take this super expansive point of view, we could actually be in a dispute about who the supplier has as the program manager. All that language about negotiating good faith and then we're going to sue the pants off of you is really ridiculous. And we've got to scale our thoughts about dispute resolution down and empower people at the peer-to-peer level and create scaffolding so that if that supplier program manager is not working with the client counterpart, how do we roll that up to the next level for resolution quickly and efficiently and maintain the relationship and not worry about clause 45 in the general terms that says, oh, we'll negotiate in good faith and then sue you.
Yeah. Love that. I think that's absolutely correct. You know, the people that are listening to this right now, especially, you know, those leaders that want something that they can give to their employees to develop them. And then those employees that are developing are probably thinking, okay, how do I get this? So how do they get this?
So on Amazon, if you were to type in the title of the book, The Contract Professional's Playbook, the playbook will come up and you can order copies on Amazon. The playbook itself not only has all the chapters, 18, that discuss all the principles, but it's also got the 25 tools associated with the different aspects of the contract lifecycle, checklists and spreadsheets and things like that. For training, if you can go to my website, www.jnyden.com, you'll see the Contract Professional Playbook as an offering. And if you click through, you can learn more information about the self-paced online program that Lawrence and I developed collaboratively. So it's got webinars and videos, and you get the playbook and tools and potentially even coaching if you'd like. So that's where you can find out more information about really digging into the training aspect of the playbook.
Fantastic. And then Jeanette, how do people follow you online?
Again, I'm on Twitter, I'm on LinkedIn, I have a YouTube channel, and everything can be found by my name, Jeanette Nyden. There's really no one else with that name. So if you type in Jeanette Nyden, you can find me.
Awesome. And Lawrence, what about you? How can people follow you online?
I'm pretty much just on LinkedIn. I don't really have time for other stuff, although people tell me I should. So you can find me on LinkedIn, and it's Kane with a K, K-A-N-E, and pretty easy to find that way.
Awesome. Just so that you know, listeners, I will be linking out to all of the social profiles of Jeanette and Lawrence, as well as places where you can buy the book. Jeanette and Lawrence, thank you so much for being on the show. I really, really appreciate your time. I know that you guys have sunk a ton of work into developing this book, and I know that you're both very proud of it, and you should be, because this just doesn't exist anywhere else. So I think it's going to be a very, very big value add to a lot of departments helping to get their teams through the development process. So thank you for what you've done, and thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
Hey, friends. Thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get, because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.